we're ready to roll. I have some handouts.
Do you want me to hand them out?
Yeah, that'd be great. Anybody have a definition of poetry? When I was in seventh grade, my definition was, what's poetry? I don't know, but it sucks. Well, just say it like it is. Come on, just talk straightforward and see what's up. I would like to put together just your own sense of what poetry is or does. And I'll just be your recording secretary and put some of that on the board here. Poetry.
Images.
Name of the game. Images. And I want to put an exclamation point because that's great. It's the first thing. What's the best image I can think of to represent this bigger concept? And a poet's going to wrestle with that. Great, you had one.
I said rhyming.
Yeah.
Rhythm.
And a lot of great poems don't. And rhythm. 19th century, big issue. Wordsworth says it's got to be the language of the common folks. It's got to be speaking language. And he doesn't have to have the Robert Frost, some kind of Michael Plater.
I think a wordplay, like just I mean, not necessarily rhyming, but just, you know, playing with different words.
It's a great phrase. I like it. Wordplay. And what does this word mean? A lot of, full of ambiguity, full of uncertainty, full of double meanings. Yeah, that's great.
Evocative.
What?
Evocative.
Oh man, these big words. I hate that. But what do you mean by that?
I mean it brings, at least for me, brings forth feelings, new ideas.
That's good. Okay, a lot of couple things. How's that? Brings forth feelings, you said, mm-hmm. And it brings forth ideas. I mean, speaking of bringing forth ideas, you might know George Bush had a planned invitation for hundreds of American poets to come to the White House and just do their artful thing. And when we went to war in 2003, he canceled it. I think about that because poems, and he knew it. Poets are not going to be here, way to go, let's go get them. You know, they're not going to do that.
Right.
And they never have in history. They've celebrated some war heroes and so on, but they haven't supported violence and war. So they do bring forth ideas, and sometimes those ideas are so powerful, and those of us who are children of the 60s remember the songs of the 60s and how powerful they were. How many roads does a man have to go down before they call him a man? And we have civil rights, and it pops out. And so the poetry, yeah, great. Feelings, ideas, more. You're terrific. They were there.
Well, I was going to say, don't they usually try and have a deep treatise on sort of a specific subject? I mean, they aren't too broad, at least the ones I've read.
A deep treatise? Is that what you said?
Yeah. I mean, some real deep thinking about a specific subject. No?
For sure. I was actually going to, you can put your stuff away, I was going to read Paradise Lost to you today. I mean, there's some deep thinking going on there. And if you ever want to reflect on the creation story, which is this short, you know, boop, boop, in the Hebrew Bible, in Paradise Lost, it's this short. It's very, very long. And there's all kinds of complexities brought to that. You see, that's a great example. And the poetic plays of Shakespeare, all his plays are poetic. Yeah, it's good. It's deep thinking.
I'd add a word to that, Paul, which is not positive. The word would be obfuscation. I just want to give you that so you can spell it.
See, this Gustavus Adolphus says, I know Luther can't spell that stuff. Luther College, I mean. Sometimes it is. Is this right?
No.
No. Obfuscation?
U.S.
F-U. Yeah, buddy! Jeez, my son was in a movie. He's an actor. It was in the title of it first was F-U. And they had to change that before it went to production.
Inspirational?
I like it. Inspiration. And there again, the stuff we have, you know, somewhat in common. And we'll look at this today, too. I think of the music of the 60s. I mean, it was inspirational.
I think of symbolism. I think that sense of poetry is meant to be
somewhere.
Small.
It absolutely is.
And maybe some of that's already up there. I mean,
no, it's not.
The words are one thing, but it means something else. I think
sure,
that's why I didn't like poetry and literature in high school, because I would read it for what it was, and then my teacher would say, oh no, it means this. How do you know? How do you know that's what the author meant?
Well, the author might not know what he meant.
Yeah.
What she meant.
Well, in the early 60s, I went to the University of Minnesota for a talk, and I think it was Carl Sandburg. Would he still have been alive at that time?
Yep.
And he stood up there and he said, the scholars or the academics say, this is what I meant. I never meant that.
I have a story for you. Writers don't always know what they mean.
No.
And I became just sheer one little letter, just the grace. Became pen pals and then friends with William Steyer, the writer of Sophie's Choice and Confessions of Nat Turner. He's just this, there's nobody in the 20th century that has better lyrical language, and in my opinion, Sophie's Choice might be the great novel of the 20th century in America. He told this story to me. He said, I was writing Sophie's Choice. And Sophie is a story of a woman, not Jewish, who survived Auschwitz and the horrors that bury her after that, and she just, you know, she can't cope with life. And she copes partly in the beginning of the book by lying, by alcohol, by kind of romping, violent sex, anything to get her mind off of the horrors that happened to her in the past. And she won't talk about them. She has no pictures of her past. And one of the lies she tells is that my father, she's Polish, my father was a great supporter of the Jews, and he tried to help the Jews. And he's 100 pages into a 590-page novel. That he doesn't go back and write over, he just keeps going. It took him 8 years. I asked him, do you have a plot line along the wall? Nope, I just go. And I saw the guy's a genius, he can remember this stuff. But he wasn't comfortable with Sophie's lies, with Sophie's stories, I should say, that my father was helping the Jews. So I went, Steyer was talking, I went to Auschwitz and lived there for 6 weeks. I just lived among the Poles. You know, this is 40 years post Holocaust. But he got a sense of the still somewhat prevalent anti-Semitism of Poland, and really I think a lot of historians think that Poland might have been the most anti-Semitic country. But he came back and went on writing again, and this is what he said. Sophie had been lying to me. He said, well, who the heck's writing the story? And that's my point. That's a long answer, sorry for. The things come out of a writer's brain and heart and soul that they can't always figure out where they came from. My initial contact with him was, I'd been teaching Sophie's Choice for probably 6, 7, maybe 10 years. And I wrote, said, I think it's, you know, I praised it. This is the greatest novel and it's really teachable. Students love it. And I sent him a study guide that I used in class. I teach at Augustana Standard College in Rock Island, Illinois. These are college students. And some of the most important and kind of fundamental themes of Sophie's Choice are theological. The book, one of the lines at the end is, tell me, where was God at Auschwitz? And the response is, tell me, where was man? I mean, who's responsible for Auschwitz? It's not God. And those kind of theological questions, where was God? Sophie asks it all the time. She dismisses God. She says, there's a... This is really a long response, I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's good.
She says at one point, I love classical music, but there's this one piece I cannot listen to, and it's those Handel, it's the Handel Messiah records that Nathan gave me. I cannot listen to it, my heart turns to stone, and I cry and cry and cry, because, and then she quotes the soprano aria, I know that my Redeemer liveth. She says, I know that my Redeemer does not live, and I will not see God, and my body will turn to worms. Or will be destroyed by worms. And she just quotes, you know, the antithesis of that whole soprano aria. Anyway, throughout the study guide, it lifts up these theological themes. And Steyer wrote back to me, and this is kind of where the friendship started, and said, I love your study guide. These theological themes are a surprise to me because I'm not religious at all. Perhaps this should require further study. by me. By himself, not by the poles. Yeah, where does this come from? How do you see this there? And so it's a long answer to it. I don't think you have your puzzle to the poem. Let's talk to the author and see what she says. It comes from, we've all been in conversations and you've said something and you said, where did that come from?
Yes.
You know, we do it all the time.
Yeah.
That all comes out of your response to symbolism. Symbols represent something, but they also participate in the thing that they represent. And I think we'll see that in some of the stuff we look at.
Isn't that the lifelong notion of Bible study? I mean, we just don't study it once and then quit.
Yeah.
Sure. Or get years down the line and say, oh, I've been lying to myself. That's not what I believe now anymore.
Yep. Great statement and great analogy with the biblical studies. And it's a living word, and great poetry is living. You know, the high school word we always heard is universal, right? Applies to all people at all times. Well, the great stuff does, because it speaks to the truth that changes. Truth change.
There's a quote from Archibald MacLeish, a poem should not mean but be.
Yeah, that's great. We'll put it up here. Not mean, but be. Archibald MacLeish wrote J.B., and Marty is talking about Job in Bible study. And MacLeish dealt with the big questions in J.B. of existence and the notion of intervention, God's intervention, and so on. This is another way of saying it, and I've had two other sessions this week, and I've argued, there we did fiction, that literature is not just about something. It's not about experience. It is, but it's not only about experience. It also just is an experience. And I would hope that those of us who were together Monday and Tuesday, we experienced the laughter and the fun of dysfunctional families, but we also experienced the poignancy and the love and the pain and the brokenness, and we experienced it. We felt it. I saw people with tears in their eyes. So it doesn't just mean to be. I love it. Thank you for sharing that. Yes.
Do you think there's any difference really between what we call poetry and what we call prose that is also evocative, symbolic, inspirational? I mean, what's the difference?
Anybody? Poetry is more compact.
Yeah.
I have another. No one ever nobody wants to ask questions. The answers are just doggone long. Styron again writes about or talks about how he'll wrestle with just one word. I mean, he's got 530 pages to write, 8 years of writing, and is this the right word? The poet is going to wrestle. I know I'm kind of contradicting myself, because there's a fiction writer that does wrestle with the words. But for sure, it's more compact. For sure, sentence structure doesn't follow normal grammar, but then neither does Faulkner in fiction. You know, his sentences will be 3 pages long, and you have to have note cards as you're going to write them down to see what's going on. But it's worth it. And maybe after we look at a couple of poems, we can answer that ourselves. That's good teaching right there. If you don't know the answer, cop out and say, we're going to figure this out together. Okay. Anything else that we want to just pay attention to? This matters, and it doesn't matter because it's sing-song and we have to force it. If it becomes sing-song, the rhythm takes over the meaning, and it becomes almost, nostalgic and schmaltzy, and you're not going to put a poem about the Holocaust in rhyme.
Right.
You can't. So, but rhyme and rhythm matter, and we'll look at that. Anything else that you... This is really good, and I think our list is great. Maybe we'll add to it as we go. Maybe we don't care.
I'll challenge you a little bit about the Holocaust in rhyme. I mean, hip hop is an incredibly different meter for my generation.
Yep. You're right. Okay, so there goes. most. I think you're right. And hip-hop, I don't know enough about it, but I know enough about it and I've heard enough of it to know that there's really profound stuff in a lot of that, yeah. Let's look at this Arkansas 12th grade reading test. This is our first introduction to poems, and you are a 12th grade reader. Anybody that wants to, just read that. First one, test number one. Anybody?
M.R. Ducks.
M.R.
Not.
Wines.
Well, you got it right. Yeah, well, I do this with high school or college students, and Mr. Ducks, Mr. Knott, Sar, Sim Wangs. A lot of you did that?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, let's look at number four. M.R. Mice, M.R. Knott, S.A.R., C.M.E.D.B.D. Feet. Well, I be M.R. Mice. Or my Minnesota favorite, M.R. Farmers, M.R. Knott, S.A.R., C.M. Empty Pockets. Well, I be M.R. Farmers. Well, that's enough. How we read something matters. Yesterday I had on the board the first line from Keats's Ode on the Grecian Urn. Thou still unravished bride of quietness. And if you say it, thou still unravished bride of quietness, he's looking at an urn and he's thinking about his own immortality and the immortality of the urn and his own mortality. Thou still, comma, unravished bride of quietness is different than thou still unravished, right? I mean, it's going to be ravished someday, maybe, but not if you say thou still unravished bride of quietness. So we can talk a lot about how poems are written, and how poems are read, and I have the wrong one here. I need the Dover Beach one. Oh, they're here, okay. The description on the kiosk says some of the greatest poetry ever written. It's pretty tough to squeeze that in about 40 minutes, isn't it? So what I decided to do was give some representative poems of how poets respond to the intellectual milieu of the day, and then how poets and poems respond to the intellectual movements of the day and apply to all time. That's so abstract that we just have to look at the specifics. In Memoriam, on the right-hand column on that first page, is a very long poem by Alfred Lord Tennyson. And Tennyson writes in the middle and the later parts of the 19th century, so he's in the 1800s. Just for the fun of it, let's point out that here's some dates that I just happened to remember. 1857 is the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species. I think it's something like 1871, or I don't know for sure, is Darwin's The Descent of Man. This is shocking stuff. At the same time that these biological theories are coming out, we've got a guy named Charles Lyell, who's a geologist in England, and he's starting to tell us, you know what, when we look, he doesn't say it this way at all, when we look at this biblical account of creation, that the earth is, we can count back up to about 6,000 years old, and I found this rock that's 5 billion. I'm really oversimplifying. But these theories of the age of the earth come in, and all of a sudden, it's as shocking to people who think about the nature of the universe and its relationship to however they see God. This is shocking stuff. It's, I think, no less shocking than Copernicus when he says, you know what, the sun doesn't rotate around the earth and we're not the center of the solar system or of the universe for him. We all know that kind of stuff, right? Well, these first two poems are responding to, we'll put them up here, Darwin, and Lyell, and these are people who have faith, who have been brought up and have thought a lot about the depths and the breadths of their own Christian beliefs. So here's this long In Memoriam poem, and it's 100 pages long. And I just, I thought that if I read that, it would take too long. Here's just an excerpt from that. And the In Memoriam poem is Tennyson's response to his very best friend has died. And this long thing, he gives all kinds of complex thoughts and puts this into both the context of intimate love, in the context of God's divine creation, in the context of his own theology, and tries to make sense out of this death of this dear friend. So there are the CXX111, if you remember your Latin, you know what that means. I had Latin, but I don't remember. There rolls the deep where grew the tree. Simple. But it participates in the reality. What do you have there? First line. There rolls the deep where grew the tree. Now, let me help you out here. Don't look for symbolism. Just literally, what's going on? There's the deep, the sea, and there used to be a tree there. That's all we're going to get. What do you make of that? The
sea went up.
The sea went up. So there have been some pretty big changes, and Britain hasn't always been this little green island right here. It's all just, but these are huge geological, right, changes. There rolls the sea. And so he's right away, first line off, in the middle of the poem. Looking at, okay, Lyle, you might be right. What's the importance of that? There rolls the deep where grew the tree. O earth, what changes hast thou seen? We just come to hold them. You know what? They're going to change the river here, how it flows through here. We've all, anybody that's been here over, 20 years for sure, knows that the glaciers are smaller. Right? I mean, O earth, what changes hast thou seen? There, where the long street roars, hath been the stillness of the central sea. Are there places like that that you know of? Where the long street roars, hath been the stillness of the central sea.
Minnesota, and I mean.
Sure.
Yeah.
Before the, not the sea, but the ice age comes, and we change and cut the rivers, and okay. The hills are shadows, and they flow from form to form, and nothing stands. We'll come back and read the whole thing put together. I mean, all 100 verses. What we have here. But think about this. The hills are shadows and they flow from form to form and nothing stands. Now, we've got a symbol. But you can figure it out. This isn't something hidden away. The symbol is all of these earth's changes, all of these geological, geographic changes have occurred. But I've heard out of that, nothing stands. What else doesn't stand? A tree doesn't stand. The mountain is sunk in the ocean. You know? Our everything we've believed about God and the universe and about the time and about my importance in this place, nothing stands. And now, add to that his own personal grief, and whoo! They melt like mist, the solid lands, like clouds, they shape themselves and go. Any thoughts? How fast is this happening? They melt like mist. It might take a million years. But who among us hasn't thought about that? You know, who am I? And I look at that mountain out there and think, I don't know when that was made. 50,000 years ago, 100,000, a million? They melt like mist, the solid lands like clouds, they shape themselves and go. But, and this is how these, in this case men, of faith, have to bring their faith into all these new scientific kinds of discoveries. How do you, you've seen some of these great Discovery Channel things of the cameras that have taken out into space and go into different galaxies. That's Barbara Rossum's husband's name. Yeah, he brought his telescope one day, or one week up here, and we were sitting up by Channel 10. and he had a thing just focused on a star. I looked in here and I looked in there and I said, wow, that really is something. He said, that's not a star, that's a galaxy. I passed out. I didn't really. I just looked into another galaxy. They melt like mist, the sullen lands like clouds that shape themselves and go. But in my spirit will I dwell and dream my dream and hold it true, for though my lips may breathe adieu, I cannot think the thing farewell. Just in your guts. Literary criticism, literary analysis always starts in the guts, not the head. We'll get to the head. You guys said this. It evokes feelings.
Hope.
What?
Hope.
Hope. In my spirit will I dwell. Hold true to my dream. Though my lips may say goodbye, and his language is better, breathe adieu, I cannot think the thing farewell.
Yeah, so what seems transient isn't.
Ooh.
It speaks eternity.
It speaks eternity. What seems transient isn't. And something is bigger than all of this stuff here. Okay, I get you, Charles Lyell. Okay, I get you. Okay, something's bigger. That which we dare invoke to bless our dearest faith, our ghastliest doubt, he, they, one, all, within, without, the power and darkness whom we guess, I found him not in world or sun or eagle's wing or insect's eye, nor through the questions men may try, the petty cobwebs we have spun. I didn't find him there. If e'er when faith had fallen asleep, I heard a voice, believe no more, and heard an ever-breaking shore that tumbled in the godless deep, the warmth within the breast would melt the freezing reason's colder heart. And like a man in wrath, the heart stood up and answered, I have felt. Did we get that? I'm not asking you to understand it. I'm asking you to, what feeling is evoked. Listen to that again. And here's where the rhythm and the rhyme and the language itself and the compactness of these images matter. I found him not in the world or sun, da-da-da. If e'er when faith had fallen asleep, I heard a voice, believe no more. Right? That's Darwinianism. That's Lyellism. You know, the new geology, the new biology. Believe no more. You can't do it. If we don't think this is a big deal, I have saved the covers off of Time and Newsweek and U.S. News and the World Report that dealt with some story of creation. I got about 12 of them. Front page, cover, Newsweek. Remember Bill Moyer had a thing on TV, public, about this the creation story on PBS, maybe 5-10 years ago, I don't know. When he had that cover of Newsweek, big picture of the Earth, you know, the one taken from the moon guys on the cover. Creation, is it real? That's the underneath. Is Jesus, was there really a resurrection? Cover. These questions they don't stop. They started when Copernicus said, they started before that. They started talking to Jesus. But here it comes again. I heard a voice, believe no more. Heard an ever-breaking shore that tumbled in the godless deep. In the face of all this, I heard a voice, a warmth within the breast would melt the freezing reason's colder heart. There's no trick to warmth within the breast, is there? I mean, I've known love. I've known compassion. A warmth within the breast would melt the freezing reason's colder part. Like a man in wrath, the heart stood up and answered, I have felt. And so what do you think he's doing with these new academic theories? These new scientific theories? Okay, that's fine.
Yes, but.
But. They don't wipe out all this, yeah. So the people that fight over the evolution stories are asking all the wrong questions. I've always contended the literal interpretation of the Bible has gone to court about 60 times. And there's no other book in the world that has. You know, I don't go to court with somebody that disagrees with me about what the meaning of Huckleberry Finn is. We talk, discuss, we set up courses, we argue, the teachers take off and write essays and we throw the crap away. Genesis goes to court. If you don't believe, there have been Scopes trials, right? We know that. And it went to court, quotes around that, for two centuries, in different ways. The idea of reason versus, you know, revelation, all kinds of
philosophical. It seems to me that he is speaking out of a loss. He is in grief.
Yes.
And he's speaking out of his relationship to this person.
Yep.
And all of these other things around there aren't speak, are nothing.
Beautiful.
What I know is what I'm feeling.
Yep. Beautiful. And what I'm feeling is true.
Yeah.
And Keats, just a little bit before Tennyson, says, beauty is truth. Truth is beauty. That's all you know on earth. That's all you need to know. The truth is, I hurt, I've loved, and that's a different kind of truth.
It also reminds me a little bit of what Vera, and what you read yesterday, of her, in spite of what the other kids are saying, I mean, she still does what she has to do.
Yeah, it's good. I'm going to write down A for you, connections between me and you. But let's keep going. The heart said, I have felt. No, like a child in doubt and fear, but that blind clamor made me wise. Then was I as a child that cries, but crying knows his father near. It's tricky language, but if we just kind of sit back and don't try to make it do something that it doesn't do, like a child in doubt and fear, we've all been there. A little afraid, God, if this is true, does that mean that everything I've always thought is meaningless? Doubt, fear. But that blind clamor made me wise. One of the major themes that runs through the whole 19th century of Western poetry is this movement from innocence into experience. Blake, that's his language. This movement from innocence into knowledge. And you could apply that to the creation of the Adam and Eve story. Are Adam and Eve better off now knowing the difference between whether they're naked or not, between good and evil? I don't know, but one way I read that story is it's God who sticks the sword of the cherubim in the border of Eden and the wilderness, says you can't go back. I don't want you there in that land of innocence and robotic autonomous thinking. You're going to have to wander in the wilderness and find love and heal brokenness and find faith. So the clamor, the fall, Milton calls it the rise, the fortunate fall, he says. Thank goodness they did that, or they'd just be a bunch of robots. So here we are. That blind clamor made me wise. Then was I as a child that cries, but crying knows his father near, and here at times a sentinel who moves about from place to place and whispers to the worlds of space in the deep night, all is well. But being well is not without all of this challenge and doubt and confusion and threats to, there's something bigger. And all is well, though faith and form be sundered in the night of fear. Well roars the storm to those that hear a deeper voice across the storm. Your own words. Is he better off? He's lost this dearest friend. And he's lost, all is lost, this whole channel. This is a intimate personal response to a personal intimate experience and a theological, academic, worldwide, historical menu that's dumped on him and he didn't want it. Well, I'm not going to read the whole thing over, but just read enough so that we see what the poetry does to the concepts and the feelings that we've just evoked. There rolls the deep where grew the tree. O earth, what changes hast thou seen? There where the long street roars hath been the stillness of the central sea. The hills are shadows and they flow from form to form and nothing stands. They melt like mist, the solid lands. Like clouds, they shape themselves and go. But in my spirit will I dwell, and dream my dream, and hold it true. For though my lips may breathe adieu, I cannot think the thing farewell. Watched Dover Beach, really a famous poem. I bet everybody studied. No, they don't anymore. And that's kind of too bad, but here's Dover Beach. And if anybody else wants to read, feel free. This is a contemporary. It's Matthew Arnold, a contemporary of Tennyson's, but in this time too. And since we got to cover more than this, we want to do it. The sea is calm tonight. He's just kind of looking out over Dover Beach. The sea is calm tonight. The tide is full. The moon lies fair upon the straits. On the French coast, the light gleams and is gone. The cliffs of England stand glimmering and vast out in the tranquil bay. Come to the windows, sweet as the night air. Only from the long line of spray where the sea meets the moon-blanched land, listen. You hear the grating roar of pebbles which the waves draw back and fling at their return up the high strand, begin and cease, and then again begin with tremulous cadence slow, and bring the eternal note of sadness in. Boy, you know what's going on, don't you? What? He's just looking out the window and what's that? Literally.
Waves are washing away.
Washing away?
Washing the England away.
Yeah. They're just washing the shore away. And I mean, this is a big geological happening, and tremulous cadence slow and being the eternal note. And he's sad because there's change. Big changes. We keep going. Sophocles long ago heard it on the Aegean, and it brought into his mind the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. We find also in the sound a thought, hearing it by this distant northern sea. Now, this geological time that he's watching, sand being rolled away, and then he refers to, Sophocles thought about that. Misery goes on forever too, okay, but here's his thought. The sea of faith was once too at the full. We didn't have any questions about that. The earth is 6,000 years old, and we're the center of the universe. Well, the sea of faith was once too at the full. And round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled, but now I only hear its melancholy, long, withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind down the vast edges, drear, and naked beaches of the world. What's happening to faith? It's long, withdrawing roar. If you went to a church college, PLU, St. Olaf, Augustine, Luther, Gustavus, I'm going to bet $1 million you were told something like this by your religion teacher. Those are campfire stories. Let's get serious. Did you? I mean, I've watched kids, counseled kids who have come out of the literalism of the Bible, and all of a sudden they got this Harvard scholar telling them, no, we've got to look at this a little bit differently, and they're crushed. Because, you mean I can't look at the world the way I did? You mean Noah didn't put all the animals just like that? You know, you mean maybe this didn't happen, maybe this didn't happen. And the sea of faith was once too, but now I hear its long withdrawing roar. So, how do we respond to that? Here's Matthew Arnold. Ah, love, and he's talking to his lover. Ah, love, let us be true to one another. It's his wife. For the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. Hopeless? The response? The intimate, emotional and intellectual response to this new historical menu is, let us be true to one another. For the world, it changes, but there's something else. It's different, but we see similar kinds of thinking with Tennyson, Arnold. This is late 19th century stuff. Yeats is a little bit later. I won't read the whole thing, but just the first stanza of Yeats. This could have been written contemporary with Arnold and Tennyson. It's not. This is written right after World War I. Does this make sense? So we have to think of World War II, more likely the Korean War, more likely Vietnam. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. Center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. We've been through a time like that. Well, let's flip over. Anything?
We got the poem of Matthew Arnold has an existentialist ring to
it. Oh, for sure. Talk about it.
So in that last stanza, where he's really saying that what is beautiful and what is true we cannot find outside of ourselves, so we are compelled to find it within ourselves.
Yes. No nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. Hello? We are here.
And in those lines of Yeats, the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. What brilliance.
Yeah.
In those lines.
Yeah. Good. Thank you.
It strikes me that even though knowing when these poems were written in the context gives them additional meaning, the greatness of the poetry is that it's also universal. I mean, you could read these without any knowledge of the times.
Yep.
And be touched.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. And that's why they are still worth reading. This is the human experience, no? Mm-hmm. Wrestling with the biggest questions of all. And I think great poetry, it has to do all of this stuff. I joked the other day about I did a little, the cat and the fiddle, the cow jumped over the moon. That doesn't really satisfy us. Nice rhythm, cute images, but it's got to deal with something meaningful. It's got to represent the deepest, I mean, the deeper they go, the better it is. Paradise Lost, the best. The deepest complexities of the human experience. Okay, well, not all of them are so. The woodpile. That's on the very back. Where did I put that? Third page, the woodpile. This is Robert Frost. By the way, Frost, I have it here. Every anthology of Frost's work is introduced by this poem. I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. I'll only stop to rake the leaves away and wait to watch the water clear, I may. I shan't be gone long. You come too? I'm going out to fetch the little calf standing by the mother. It's so young it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long. You come too. He's going to go out and do, I have a wake up, now you don't have to come. What do you call it? Eye opener? Yeah, tomorrow. That's all I'm going to do is tell that little poem. I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. Pasture springs have been doing fine for eons. We don't need to be clean. And you picture this guy out there with a rake. I'll stop to rake the leaves away, and then wait to watch the water clear, I may. I shan't be gone long. You come too. This is unnecessary, impractical, but it's so meaningful he has to share it. You come too. I don't know how when we domesticated cattle, calves were doing just fine with mother cows, right? I'm going out to fetch the little calf standing by the mother. It's so young, and now he's already in kind of enraptured by the creation. It's so young, it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I mean, he's still got afterbirth on him, and he's just going, come on, we got to go see this. It isn't come and help me get my fitness regimen in. It's not come and help me balance my checkbook. Or let's go look at our nutrition program. So that is practical, good stuff. Well, that's a theme that runs through all of his poetry. And ultimately, it's a theme that runs through all poetry, is that there's something bigger out there than just the historical menu and the mechanics and the logistics of the present. So here's the woodpile. Out walking in the frozen swamp one gray day, I paused and said, I will turn back from here. No, I will go on farther, and we shall see. You ever been on a hike? Okay, that's all it is. So, look, we don't have to find anything symbolic, but we will find something meaningful. The hard snow held me, save where now and then 1 foot went through. The view was all in lines, straight up and down of tall, slim trees, too much alike to mark or name a place by, so as to say for certain I was here or somewhere else. You been there? I left right by that tree. Well, that tree is a mile back there. He doesn't even know where he's going. And that matters. It's to get that in the whole story, the whole poem. I was just far from home. A small bird flew before me. He was careful to put a tree between us when he lighted and say no word to tell me who he was, who was so foolish as to think what he thought. He thought that I was after him for a feather, the white one in his tail. Like one who takes everything said as personal to himself, one flight out sideways would have undeceived him. Explain that little part there. He's thinking what the bird is thinking. And of course the bird isn't thinking that. He thought, the bird is there thinking, he's after my tail. But what? Just one little flight away, and he'll find out I'm not, because I'm not going to chase him. And I love this line. Like one who takes everything said as personal to himself. I hated that rain today. Oh, you didn't like my class? And then there was a pile of wood for which I forgot him and let his little fear carry him off the way I might have gone without so much as wishing him good night. He went behind it to make his last stand. It was a cord of maple, cut and split and piled, and measured 4 by 4 by 8. And not another like it could I see. No runner tracks in this year's snow looped near it. And it was older, sure, than this year's cutting, or even last year's or the years before. The wood was gray and the bark warping off it, and the pile somewhat sunken. Clematis had wound strings round and round it like a bundle. What held it, though? On one side was a tree still growing, and on one a stake and prop, these latter about to fall. I thought that only someone who lived in turning to fresh tasks could so forget his handiwork on which he spent himself, the labor of his axe, and leave it there, far from a useful fireplace to warm the frozen swamp as best it could with the slow, smokeless burning of decay. What's that? We know what that's about, don't we? Tell me. That's a bad way to ask that. I know, I don't know, so I'm not gonna. Literally, what did this guy do? Made a wood pile? And forgot about it.
Or
worked pretty hard at it.
Or maybe he didn't forget it. Maybe he's dead.
Could be dead. We sure don't know that. And that's not that's not a crazy kind of conjecture. Could so forget his handiwork in which he spent himself, the labor of his axe, and leave it there far from a useful place. I never thought of this till right now. When I was really little, last week, we had the cement steps, and about 4 steps before a cement landing going into our back porch in our house in Minnesota. And one of the things I did a lot, which says something, I'm afraid. I'd get a Skippy peanut butter jar full of water and a paintbrush, and I'd paint the sidewalk. And it was light gray, right? And as soon as I painted it, dark gray. As soon as I got to the top, the bottom step was light gray, and it dried. But I must have, as a little kid, sure didn't know the word existential, but I must have found some existential meaning in this act of painting those steps. And I would just spend myself in the labor of my paintbrush and leave it there, far from a useful fireplace. So how does poetry speak there? To you, in your guts.
How will we judge another's work?
Great answer, geez. Another's work. Another's, and then we expand it into another's life. This is what they've done.
There's a bit of whimsy.
The other is. And the whimsy fits, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. The whole attitude of the poem. Ha, the bird, me, it's crazy to think. That's just solid wood. Then I said on there, could bring some. Anybody bring me? I've not got enough in case you didn't. can do it in 5 minutes. I'll tell you what I think this is about. The story of this poem is very famous. You've probably read it. These two guys in the spring, they live on either side of a stone fence in New England. And in the spring, they decide to go put the stones back up that have tumbled down during the winter. And they're going to put them back. And I'll just point out to you ahead of time that the guy that I want to pick these up. So I'm going to say, let's put the boulders back. I suggested to you, but then I criticize you for doing this thing that's just meaningless. It's just stupid. Why do you do this? But I'm the one that suggests it. And there seems to be some kind of historical, cultural, institutional, if you can institutionalize this act, thing that keeps calling, I'm going to do this no matter what. And I don't know how to fight this feeling that comes in me all the time. And I'm not really free. You see what you do with it. Robert Frost read this at the German Wall in 1960. The East German Wall. You ever find the Mending Wall? You can read it. It says, wall. The top where it's cut off. Something there is that doesn't love a wall that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I've come after them and made repair where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but it's spring mending time we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day, and here's where rhythm matters, watch this, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. Rhythm. I do. We keep the wall between us as we go. To each the boulders that have fallen to each, and some are loaves, and some so nearly balls, we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. So they don't care if they fall. Just get them up, right? And then if they fall, they don't care. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more. There, where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he set it for himself. I see him there bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand, like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, and not of woods only, in the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying. And he likes having thought of it so well, he says again, good fences make good neighbors. That's our last one. What do we do with that?
Well, just we like the irony of the good, because without the fence, maybe they'd never talk to each other.
Yep.
And so the fence does make neighbors.
It does.
It's ironic.
And yet they don't care about it. Put the bowl up and knock it out of there before it falls apart. Yeah.
When you travel in New England, you see all these stone walls,
sure,
going out in the woods that don't have any meaning anymore. And you think, that's too bad. You know, I think that.
Sure. Well, look what it did for these two guys. Apparently they never even talked the rest of the year. Time to put the fence up. And it's stupid. And we didn't want to do it. Why are we doing this? But something in him says, I suggest, right, he starts the whole thing. So there's all this positive, and then there's this negative that he can't get out from under this kind of ritual. Is the ritual meaningful?
Yes.
It's not practical. The rock's going to fall down.
Yeah, I bet he'd miss it if he couldn't do it.
Apparently, because he doesn't. The spring comes. And it's mischief in me. I don't know why I'm doing it. Well, there's
one thought.
Yes.
We asked the question before, difference between prose and poetry. And I was just thinking, You could take this poem that you just read and do now what we're doing and embellish all this stuff with more thinking, more sentences, more insight. So poetry is maybe a very condensed story without a whole bunch of not necessarily bad additions.
No cliff notes, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, could just take here and add those in?
That's a phrase that we could put there, is that poetry is surely condensed, and every image is so important.
Yeah.
I mean, why the image, you can add, and if we wanted to. But my goal in teaching literature is to help kids like it, love it, not understand it. But if you love it, you're going to understand it. You're going to get there. But so we could break it down and say, well, what is this? Where is it? We could talk about he moves in darkness, it seems to me, out of woods, over in the shade. We can intellectually analyze that, right? The guy lives in the dark. He doesn't know what's going on. But the poem does it differently. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, out of woods, only in the shade of trees. Language is it. That's why everybody on Monday went like this. When Papa and Mama are in a big fight and Papa has a grin, and they think the fight is over, and the fight comes back, and David Duncan says, and the grin is wiped off like ice cream off a melting ice cream off a kid's ice cream cone. And the image of this thing melting, I mean, are you with me? He's picked an image. It works perfectly to destroy, to show the pain of this. It's a little kid, it's his ice cream cone, and this is Mama and Papa's fight, and I thought they were done with it, and they're not. If you haven't read it, it's probably a bad idea.
Paul? Yep. What I love about this poem is that, to me, it seems like he's describing his own yearning for something to move forward in a relationship with his neighbor, but he's describing it in terms of almost geological forces in the earth. You know, like he says, something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen ground swell under and spills the upper boulders. And it's like he's, you know, the image of mixed gaps, even two can pass abreast, the image of two people walking abreast.
Good.
And then, you know, so he's like, he's talking about his own yearning, but he's seeing it in the forces of nature that spill these boulders from the wall.
Yeah, that's very good. And then we can keep going, it's really good, and we can keep going to that. Well, it's elves. It's not elves exactly. It's something. And that all adds to your notion of this yearning that he has to have this. Yeah, it's good.
Do we know it's in he? Writing?
Well, Robert Frost wrote it. That's all. That's the only reason. But that's a great point. We don't know that the speaker in this poem, no.
Well, I'm sorry, Paul. I thought it was Mary Oliver.
No. And it does say that. I put the Mary Oliver poem in case you guys were all quiet and wouldn't talk. You had to get more poems done. Mary Oliver, where is that? Mary Oliver wrote The Summer Day.
I see, okay.
Sorry.
So I was trying to attach. We keep saying he.
What
if it were?
Yeah. Well, that's great. What if it sure could be. He moves in darkness, and if the woman is the speaker is a woman, huh? Maybe I should write Mary Oliver. Did you write this? She said, "No, I plagiarized it out of an anthology by Robert Frost." Okay, thank you. That's good.
Thank you.